You know, thank you guys enough. Thank you so very, very much. Good, good, good. Revelation chapter 13 tonight. We're going to go back and review just a little bit to get a feel of where we are. There are outlines in the back if you do not have them. They're available to you. Going to attempt to pick up some of the highlights of this chapter and just follow it through together. So join with me as we begin. First of all, just some things that lead up to this section. I want to just draw your attention to a few things in here. Notice, if you will, I start with Revelation 12:6, the statement we look at here. The woman fled. This is Israel, fled in the wilderness where she had a place prepared by God so that there she might be nourished for 1,260 days. Then notice, if you will, in verse 14, and the two wings of the great eagle were given to the woman in order that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she was nourished for a time and times, one and two, that's three, and a half a time from the presence of the serpent. Now, they're referring to the same period of time. One refers to a 1,260 days. The other refers it to a time and times, one time, two times, that makes three and a half a time, three and a half. Then you go down to chapter 13, verse 5, and there was given him a mouth speaking arrogant words and blasphemies and authority to act for 42 months was given him. So 1,260 days, time, times, and a half a time, and now 42 months, all of them referring to the same period of time. If you go back with me to chapter 11, you'll notice in verse 2, and leave out the court which is outside the temple, and do not measure, for it has been given to the nations, and they will tread underfoot the holy city for 42 months. So here again, 42 months. And then verse 3, and I will grant authority to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy for 1,260 days. Now, one of the things that we see very clearly in here, we're talking about a period of 42 months, 1,260 days, time, times, and a half a time. This is 3.5-year period. The tribulation is divided into two halves. The first half has already passed. It ends with the ending of the sixth seal being opened. And now we come to the latter part of the tribulation. And this is what we find for us here. It is the most intensive time of persecution of God's people ever in the history of mankind. But if I could this evening do it a different way than even title what we have, The Beast Out of the Sea, which is what we're going to talk about in a moment, I would really, title this section, How Do You Respond to the Sovereignty of God? We looked at it this morning in James. You know what theology says. You know what doctrine says. You know what God says. Now the question is, can you take what you know to be true and apply it to your life? We all have the knowledge. Chapter 8, verse 1. Verse 7, we do not all have this knowledge, the ability to take that which we know to be true and apply it to our life. How do you respond to the sovereign working of God in your life, adverse as it may be? That really is the issue of this passage. And I'm intrigued with each of these sections, what it ends with. It doesn't end with some picture of this godless world or the godless opposition. Every time it ends with a challenge to God's people is, how are you going to deal with this? So tonight, how do you deal with the sovereignty of God? That really is the question. As we come to the most, most terrible time of judgment of God's people ever in all the history of mankind, it will never be other than this, any worse than this ever could be. Now notice this, if you will, because in this context, we'll look at it just quickly. There are three groups of godly people. They're the people of Israel. Now, they are the ones who are seen as the woman in chapter 12, verse 6. They're seen in verse 14 as the wings given to this great eagle. And notice in verse 17, the serpent, verse 15 of chapter 12, poured water out like a river out of his mouth after the woman so that he might cause her to be swept away with the flood. Verse 17, the dragon was enraged with the woman and went off to make war with the rest of her offspring. So here is this woman, here is Israel. That's one of the groups of the people of God. The other are the prophets of God in chapter 11. We saw the two witnesses, and it's in verse 3 of chapter 11. They operate during the same period of time for this 1,260-day, 42-month period. So there are the people of Israel, there are these people of God, the prophets, and then finally there are the preachers of righteousness, the 144,000. And the reason why I believe they're here in chapter 12, verse 17, is because it says, and the dragon was enraged with the woman. He could not get Israel, so he went off to make war with the rest of her offspring, and that's the 144,000 who are witnessing during this time. We have three groups, the people of God, the prophets of God, and the preachers of righteousness. Now, we have three people, though, who are coming against these three groups of people. The prophets, the people of Israel, and the people of God, these ones who are preaching righteousness during this time. And what we would call a counterfeit trinity, and no doubt it is. We'll see that this evening. And so we see the first person of this trinity in chapter 12. It's the dragon, and there's no doubt who the dragon is. We're told who the dragon is in verse 9 of chapter 12. And the great dragon was thrown down, the serpent of old, who is called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. So first of all, we have the dragon. We have Satan. There's no doubt, again, who he is. We come tonight to the second of these people, and that is the beast out of the sea. And it's interesting because what happens in the latter part of chapter 12, it says, and he stood, that's the dragon, that's Satan, stood upon the sand of the sea. And I saw out of the sea a beast coming up. And this is the second part of this, if you will, this counterfeit trinity. So much like the Lord Jesus Christ, you're going to see. It is, I mean, everything that Satan does with this individual is to attempt to make him like Jesus Christ. And therefore, to bring worship to him, as we're going to find he does, and to bring worship to the dragon, who is like God the Father. If you will, God the Father would correspond with the godless one who is Satan. God the Son would correspond with this beast of the sea. And we're going to see God the Holy Spirit corresponds to the beast out of the land, which we're going to look at together next time. So we see this second part of this trinity that's coming to bear here, and we want to look at this together. So follow with me, if you will, through the outline, and we'll look at this together. First of all, this beast, the description of him. As we look at this description of the beast that is given to us in the first couple of verses, he stood on the sand of the seashore, and I saw a beast coming out of the sea. Now, the question that comes here, and I'm only going to pass over some of these things because the question is the beast coming up, I saw out of the sea, and a beast coming up out of the sea. Now, the question is, what's the sea? Some have said, well, it's the sea of mankind. The problem you have with this is that down a few verses, you have a beast out of the land. Now, if you're going to take this as just out of the sea of mankind, out of the sea of humanity rises this beast, where does the other beast come from if it comes out of the land? Some have said the sea is the Mediterranean Sea, far too small for the worldwide impact of this beast that is to come. There are those who would suggest to you that actually the sea, and it is, you find in chapter 11 and chapter 17, this beast is called the beast out of the abyss. Well, then some say, well, we don't take this literally. We'll say that this sea equals abyss. I'm just going to tell you, I need to take sea as sea, if you don't mind. And if nothing else to suggest to you that the two times that you have the abyss mentioned, that the abyss is something to do with this sea, as opposed to the other way around. The sea equals abyss. I would say the abyss is something to do with the sea. And when you talk about a beast coming out of an abyss, where in the world is this abyss? Is it out there in space somewhere? You know, where in the world is this abyss? We don't know where this abyss is. All we know is somehow this beast is the same beast that comes out of the abyss and here seen coming out of the sea. As in verse 11, I saw another beast coming up out of the earth. So there's one out of the earth, one out of the sea. And again, why the statement he stood on the sand of the seashore? How does that fit in with mankind? How does it fit in with anything else? There's sand here. There's a seashore here. And this beast is coming out of the sea. I don't understand any more of this except to say to you that in the Old Testament there are many, many references to the judgment of God and to the evil things which are associated with the sea. So this is what we have. We have this beast coming out of the sea. The characteristic of this beast is this. He has 10 horns and 7 heads, and upon the horns of him 10 diadems. Now, fascinating that you see that it is the 10 horns that stand out and the 7 heads are not the primary thing. Go with me to chapter 12, verse 3. And another sign appeared in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, we know as Satan, having 7 heads and 10 horns. Now, when you think about this, the 7 heads and 10 horns, what are the 7 heads? Well, let me tell you what the 7 heads are. I believe they're the major kingdoms of this earth which have come against Israel. As you look at this, throughout this whole section, they're the nations of the earth. And we go back to Egypt, to Syria, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome. And then there is one yet to come, which is this united Roman Empire that is yet to come, a revived Roman Empire, if you want to call it that, which involves 10 kingdoms that will arise, and one is prominent over the others. So as you look at this, it's interesting because Satan, notice the 7 heads and 10 horns in chapter 12, verse 3, and has his head or 7 diadems. In other words, Satan is the one who ultimately has provided the control for all the major kingdoms of this world that have ever existed, going back to Egypt and coming all the way through the Roman Empire. Satan stands behind all of them. What is fascinating, when it comes to the last of these empires, which is yet to come and may even be out there today, very evident, and we don't see it, but it's in God's plan. There may well be this is out there, and people have tried to draw out who they are, what are the 10 nations, and when you've got the Commonwealth of, you know, European nations, they start to say, see, it's 10, and then when they add a couple more on, they get a little bothered, what are we going to do with these? We don't know exactly who they are. You can start to guess and spend your time doing this, but there is going to be an empire that has 10 major kings to it, and it's interesting, you see that when it comes to this beast that is yet to come, beast out of the sea, his impact will be on those 10 nations, kingdoms that exist at the end time. That's why for him, the 10 crowns are on the 10 kingdoms that come at the end time. And for Satan, the crowns are on the 7 heads, if you will. Or if you look at this thing, you see what happens. You have the 10 horns, 7 heads. Satan has the crowns on the 7 heads because he controls all of the world empires that have existed. But this one who is yet to come has the crowns on the 10 horns. Why? Because he controls the 10 kingdoms of the earth that are going to come in the end as a part of a united Roman Empire that is yet to come. Now, it's interesting because upon the horns of them, there are 10 diadems, and upon the heads of them, there are names of blasphemy. One of the things that's going to be very evident is the blasphemy associated with this coming one. Fact of the matter is, a very simple thing for us to do, which would help us a bit maybe, is to keep something here and go back with me to 2 Thessalonians, just for a moment. Not too far back, okay? If you get too far back, you've gone too far. Just a few books back, 2 Thessalonians. Notice this king is going to, or this one is going to come. And I start in verse 3 of 2 Thessalonians 2. Let no one in any way deceive you, for it will not come. 2 Thessalonians 2:3. Let no one in any way deceive you, for it will not come unless, notice, the apostasy confers, and here's this man. The man of lawlessness revealed, the son of destruction. Now notice what he is. He opposes and exalts himself. This is the same man above every so-called God or object of worship, so that he takes a seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God. Now it is this individual that we're talking about here who is going to come in the end time. We can read through that passage and it depicts him, but I take you back again. It is this individual coming at the end. He's going to exalt himself to the place of God. Now, what's interesting, the blasphemous names and blasphemy of this individual all the way down to this passage, you're going to see, notice if you go down verse 5, and there was given him a mouth speaking arrogant words and blasphemies. Verse 6, and he opened his mouth in blasphemies against God to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle. That is those who dwell in heaven. One of the major characteristics of this one who is coming is that he is going to be characterized by blasphemy. Now, if you think back, during the time of the Roman Empire, remember it started from Augustus on? You have what? Emperor worship. People worship the emperors as God, and they desire to be. In fact, Caesar declined that, Julius Caesar. Augustus Caesar accepted that. And people began to worship them as God, and therefore the real problem for Christians at that time, when in fact they would not accept emperor worship, they were taking a stand then against the emperor, the one who was ruling the land at that time, which is what the problem was for many of the Christians during those days from Augustus on. Now you see, that was the beginning, but they do not even begin to be anywhere like this one's going to be when he exalts himself to be as God and seeks worship from man. And so this is what he is like, the names of blasphemy upon him. Notice something else. And the beast which I saw was like a leopard, and the feet of him like a bear, and the mouth of him like a lion. You know what's fascinating with this? It reminds us of Daniel, where you have a composite beast there. And what this is interesting, it goes back to remind us of several of Israel's enemies that are described in Daniel. All combined in one. Feet like a leopard. He was like a leopard. In other words, the swiftness, the cruelty. The feet of him as a bear. The ability to tramp and to crush. The mouth like a mouth of a lion. And it's interesting because you would think of the mouth of the lion in the sense of its ability to destroy. But in this context here, notice what happens. This, as he goes on in this passage, he's going to have a big mouth is what he's going to have. It's not so much the damage he will do as the words he will speak. This is going to be one who is characterized by a loud mouth, as we're going to see. Now notice what happens. And the dragon gave to him his power, his throne, and his great authority. This one operates in the name of and under the power of and under the direction of Satan himself. And so when this beast comes, he does not operate on his own. He operates in behalf of Satan, and Satan gives to him his power, his throne, and his great authority. Now, follow with me through here. Those are the characteristics of it. But now notice the worship of this beast, and it starts out with this, and one of his heads as having been slain unto death. Now, first of all, an interesting thing to notice here in this passage is that this statement right here, this phrase that you have right here, like this, and this one here, is exactly the same as used of Christ in a previous context in chapter 5. Christ was one having been slain, this one is one having been slain unto death. Notice, unto death. And notice what happened. The wound of his death was healed. One of the heads of this beast that is yet to come is going to be killed and going to be brought back. And so the question that comes out of this thing, was this some deceptive thing that happened? Did God give to them the ability to be able to have this happen? What in the world? But exactly the same vocabulary for Christ is here. And the purpose of it was, you see, notice, and the whole world was amazed after the beast. What's going to happen when people see the exact same thing that happened to Christ? This is just like the whole issue over again. This one will have a head that dies, is healed again, and people all over the world will be amazed at this one who was able to die and come back to life again. And because of this, it's going to lead to the worship of this individual because of the spectacular nature of the death and resurrection, if you will. And whether it's in fact a death, and whether it's in fact a true full death and a full resurrection, it is the same vocabulary entirely. And whatever it is, it will be accepted by the world this way. And what's going to happen because of this? Notice what happens. As a result of what happens in his doing, they will worship the dragon. They worship the dragon. Notice, because he gave authority to the beast, and they worship the beast, saying, who is like the beast and who is able to make war with him? You know, this is a blasphemous statement in itself. You know what the word Michael means, by the way? Michael means, it's the Old Testament Hebrew word for who is like God. No one is like God. But they will take the same kind of a statement that is used of God, and they will say, who is like the beast? No one is like the beast. And the incomparable nature of this beast is going to cause people all over the world to worship him just the same way. As people worship Christ, they will worship this beast. And just as they worship God, they will worship the dragon because of this death and this resurrection. And if you will, this ability that it seems to them to be able to stand in such a supreme position that no one can be like the beast. And no one is able to make war with him. No one. Now notice, in light of this, the activities of this beast. If this is what he is like, look at the activities that follow. You'll see, first of all, there will be blasphemy. Now, one of the things that I want you to notice in this passage, and you see twice in this page alone, see this statement here? It was given to him. It was given to him. The question, you know, throughout this book of Revelation, whenever you have this, it was given, do you know who is the giver? And this is what you need to understand, this passage. It's an incredible statement. It was given to him. He was given a big mouth. Who gave it to him? Who gave it to him? Whenever you have this impersonal statement in the book of Revelation, it's always God. God gave him a big mouth. And what did he do with it? He said great things and blasphemies. God gave to him authority to do or to act for 42 months. You know why it's God that gave the authority, even if for no other reason, as you've seen all the way through Revelation, is the fact that if Satan gave this authority, he certainly wouldn't have limited it 42 months. He'd have gone as long as he could go. But you see, predicted ahead of time is that this beast only has 42 months to do whatever he has to do. And who has given to him the 42 months to operate in? God and God alone. So much so that God can predict this is going to happen because God gives him the authority to do so. Now, I want you to think carefully about this as we go through the rest of this passage, because you see, this authority is the authority he uses to bring unbelievable judgment against God's people. Now, just rest in this for a while, because you're going to come to the last two verses, and it's going to take us back a bit. Because God gave him this authority, and notice, for 42 months, and so he has a definite prescribed amount of time given by God to be able to blaspheme this way, and to be able, if you will, to exercise this authority. Notice, therefore, what happens. In verse 6, and he opened his mouth unto blasphemies toward God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle. And it's interesting, by the way, when it goes on to say this last part is very difficult, this tabernacle in heaven goes down and equals this, those who are dwelling in heaven. In fact, this same word, if you can see this here, is the word from which this verb is taken right here. In other words, he is going to blaspheme not only the name of God, he's going to blaspheme the tabernacle of God, which is actually refers to the tabernaclers, the people in heaven who are tabernacling there, if you will, or whatever, who are dwelling there. These are the ones he's going to attack. He's going to blaspheme the name of God. He's going to blaspheme every one of God's people in heaven. He's going to just be a blasphemous person. Not only is he going to blaspheme, because that's the characteristic of this one who's yet to come, but notice what he's going to do. There's given to him. Notice again, this same statement that was given to him. Again, who gave it to him? Notice again, it was given to him. Isn't it fascinating? Four times in just these few verses, given to him, given to him, given to him. Who gave it to him? God gave him a big mouth. God gave him authority for 42 months. God gave to him the right, if you will, to continue. And this is it, to make war with the saints. And actually, even if you will, to overcome the saints. He is going to be given this. He cannot do it aside from the fact that God allows him to do it and gives to him the authority to do so. Notice the statement. There was given him authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation. Where have you seen this before in the book of Revelation? It was a positive thing in the book of Revelation earlier. One day in the future, every what? Exactly the same term. Every tribe, every people, every tongue, every nation is going to be worshiping and praising the Lamb, right? At this point, the same list of things given here. He has the authority. He has the authority over every tribe, over every people, over tongue, and every nation. He's going to make war with God's people. And in this war, he is going to, if you will, overcome God's people, which means he's going to kill a lot of God's people. Who gives him the authority? God does. Now, I just want you to pause before I go any further here, you see. We look at trials that come into our life. We want to blame them on everything else. We sang the song this evening, and that passage is so incredible. God can only give good gifts, my friend. We sang that. That's all he gives. He can't change. God cannot change. He only gives what's good. Even this, my friend, is good. It's good from the hand of God. You see, I don't think it's good. It doesn't sound good. It doesn't feel good. It's good. God cannot give anything but good gifts. God does not change. Every good act of giving and every perfect gift is from above, from the Father of lights, alongside of whom is no variation or shadow of turning. He cannot change. God cannot deny who he is. I'm going to go back there again as I look at you, Dr. Vera, here, sitting here. There's a good gift God gave to you, as terrible as it was. And even to where you are today, it was a part of the goodness of God to bring you from there to where you are. And I know you reflect back and you reflect on that very fact. But you see, this is God doing it, okay? Man cannot operate aside from the power that God gives him to operate. It cannot be. Cannot be. God is a sovereign God. God controls all events in all of human history from beginning to end. Now notice. So he has this power. He's given. Four times it says it was given to him. Notice what else happens. And then, and we won't just go into this much further because we've described earlier, but let me just look at this. And they will worship him. This is the success of this beast. How successful will he be? He'll be successful. They will worship him. All the dwellers upon the earth will worship him. All those dwellers whose names do not stand written in the book of the life of the Lamb who was slain. Look at the same firm. This same statement made right up above about this beast is made about Christ. From the foundation of the earth. Let me tell you, this foundation of the earth goes back to this. Whose names were not written from the foundation of the earth in the book of life of the Lamb. I'm not going to go there now because we've looked at earlier. Do you know what? We have our own picture of what this book is like. Do you know what it seems to be if you read earlier? Is that everybody's name was in this book originally. But names were taken out of this book, not put into this book. And these are ones whose names, in fact, is interesting because it's a perfect tense here. This stands this way. From the foundation of the earth, these people's names stand, not written in the book of the Lamb who was slain. It wasn't slain from the foundation, it was written from the foundation. And this was written from the foundation of the earth, and these people whose names are not written, they are going to worship this beast. Now, notice. Here comes the believer's response. And this is where I want us to dwell for a while because the picture is a great picture, but now comes the believer's response. If one has ears, let him hear. Now we've seen this before. We saw it in chapters 2 and 3. If one has ears to hear, let him hear. Now the question is he asking them to hear what he said in verses 1 to 8 or is he asking them to hear what he's going to say in verse 10? And let me tell you what it is, and we're not spending a lot of time, it's verse 10, not verses 1 to 8. I want you to hear this, he says. Listen carefully to what I have to say. If you have an ear to hear, let him hear. Let him hear what? Let him hear what I have to say in verse 10. And I put this in here, God wants us to respond eschatologically. You understand that we've been going through 1 Corinthians together. God wants eschatologically thinking people. Now, look at what verse 10 says. If this is what God is saying, God says, all right, this is what I want to happen. I want you to hear what I'm going to say. So here's what I have to say. In light of all this happened, understand, this beast is coming. He's going to operate under the direction of Satan himself. He's going to make himself out to be just like the Lord Jesus Christ for the very purpose of drawing people to worship him and the dragon or Satan. But I want to tell you something. Knowing all of this, and in fact, it's going to be given him authority four times. Given him authority over all the tribes and nations and people and so forth. He's going to have this, and he's going to make war, and he's going to have victory, and he's going to kill people. Now the question comes in this verse. Is a statement, if a certain one is under captivity he goes? If a certain one is to be killed by a sword, we will be killed by a sword? By the way, NASB, and I think maybe NIV, I don't know, changed this, and they took something else here. He who kills with a sword will be killed by a sword. That's not the point. God is not speaking to these evil people. God's speaking to believers. He's saying, can you accept my sovereignty? If in fact you're destined for captivity, you know what you're going to do? You're going to go to captivity. If you're destined to be killed by a sword, you know what's going to happen? You're going to be killed by a sword. Can you accept the sovereignty of God? That's basically what it's saying. Do you have an ear to hear? Can you accept the sovereignty of God and accept that which God has destined to happen to you? Can you be with Peter that day and says, you know, Peter, I got to tell you something. You're not going to want this to happen, but in your old age, you see, people are going to take you, not by your own choice. And you know, he then depicted for him the fact that Peter was going to die just as he died. And then Peter says, what about John? He says, it doesn't matter what happens to John. I'm just talking about you. Can you handle the fact that God is destined for you that this happened? You know, a godly man called me this last week. He says, we're in a Bible study. He says, I have a problem. He says, this is what came up in our Bible study. We're studying Acts 12. Now, what happens is, we study Acts 12. Peter is put in prison, just as James was put in prison. People pray. Peter gets out. And so we say to people, you see the power of prayer. Prayer got Peter out of prison. Are we trying to say then, James didn't get out of prison, he got killed? Is that because people didn't pray that he got killed? Oh, what an interesting question. This is Jesus' cousin, more than likely. This is the one who walked with him everywhere he went. Why didn't he save him? Why did he just save Peter? Peter special, James not special. The sovereignty of God destined that James would go to death and that Peter would be spared when the same design was given to him by Herod. And once again, the question comes, by the way, Peter said, I'm going to die. What about John? Now the question comes, hold it. James died. What about Peter? How come Peter doesn't die too, see? See, God in his sovereignty is destined that this might be, and God has destined whatever is coming into your life and my life, it was given that this should be. Do you understand this? In the sovereignty of God. Can you accept this fact, he says? Here is the endurance and the faithfulness of the saints. You see, what needs to be as you accept the sovereignty of God is to be encouraged by the fact that God is sovereign. These things that come into our life do not come as accidents. They're designed by God. And this was designed by God many, many years. If you realize this, designed by God specifically 2,000 years before it ever occurred, if it occurs now, and maybe even 3,000 before it happens. I don't think so, but we'll accept that, whatever. It designed this many years ago that it would happen. God says, you know what is required of us is to accept the sovereignty of God and in the midst of whatever comes to us, to have two things, endurance and faithfulness. I take you back with me to that 2 Thessalonians passage again, if you will, as we conclude this evening. It's one of the great, great, great passages in my mind, and I don't see the truth taught anywhere else. 2 Thessalonians, if you will, chapter 1. The same things again. I start in verse 3 of chapter 1. We ought always to give thanks to God for you, brethren. 2 Thessalonians 1, 3. We ought always. We're obligated, by the way, to always give thanks to God for you, brethren. This is only fitting because, notice, your faith is greatly enlarged. Your love of each one of you toward one another grows even greater. Now, notice verse 4. Therefore, because of this, we ourselves boast about you among the churches of God for two things. Your perseverance, same word. Notice here, the same word here. And the other word, exactly the same, should be translated the same way. Not your faith, but your faithfulness. Notice this. Well, I praise God for your perseverance and your faithfulness in the midst of all your persecutions and afflictions which you endured. This is not only true of the time of Revelation, it's true back there in the time of the early church. Same words, persecutions, afflictions, were responded to by the people with perseverance and faithfulness. Now notice verse 5. This is proof positive. That's how I would translate that verse, first part of verse 5. This is proof positive. What's proof positive? Your perseverance, your endurance, and your faithfulness of God's righteous judgment. Now just think with me for a while. This is why sometimes meditate on this passage for a bit. When I think of the righteous judgment of God, I look forward to that time when God is going to come and judge the people who have judged us. And I can hardly wait. Huh? And I say, you know, just wait. Wait till they get theirs, right? And you see, there is that described in 2 Thessalonians 1. But before he describes this, he says, you know what? God is righteously judging today. You see, how does he righteously judge today? Because when people are persecuted for the cause of Christ, he gives to them perseverance and faithfulness, which is positive proof of God's righteous judgment today. God will righteously judge in the future? Yes, because he's going to get those who get us. But God is righteously judging today because in the midst of the adversity he brings into our life, he gives to us faithfulness and endurance so that we might be able to walk through triumphantly. The question is not so much about the beast. The question is about the believers in verses 9 and 10. How do you respond to the adversity that comes into your life, sovereignly given by God? No accidents. No accidents. How do you respond? And I come back to the message this morning. You can know the truth of the sovereignty of God, but if in fact it doesn't flesh out in your experience, it means nothing. All men have this knowledge, but all men do not have this knowledge, the ability to take what you know to be true and apply it to your life and make a difference. And you know, we can look at the future and say, all right, this applies to them this way. How does it apply to me today? And the things that God brings into my life, do I respond with endurance? Do I respond with faithfulness in the midst of trials? Because I realize that God is a sovereign God and God sustains me in whatever he brings into my life. That's the message of Revelation 13. Verses 1 to 10. All right. With that, let's move into a time of just sharing some prayer requests that we can take with us as we leave this evening.